Hello and welcome to the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about academia and sort of PhD life, aren't we, Josh?
We are, and today we're joined back by our great friend Craig Jones.
Yeah, thank you for having me back.
Craig, you're doing ethnocentrism.
Ethnofuturism.
Craig, you're doing ethnofuturism, and you're interested in space and stuff like that.
Yeah, should point out outer space.
Outer space, yes.
I think you're talking about the 2D rather than 3D.
Yeah, but like us, you're also your final year PhD student.
Hopefully final year.
That's we say this optimistically when we talk about final year, because I think that's the same with us as well, really.
Yeah.
But you're also a union rep as well.
Yeah, I'm a UCU PGR rep for Lancaster University.
What's that? Is that the University Colleges Union? Is that?
So UCU is the University Colleges Union, and yeah, I'm the Lancaster University, UCU, PGR rep. All so the initials.
You represent all the postgraduates at the university's council union thing.
Yep.
Essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, cool. So he's a good guy to have on the podcast with us today. We hope.
Yeah, I think Craig's got the inside track on academic life and PhD.
Should point out as a side note, I'm not here in UCU capacity. I'm here as an individual, so anything I say is purely my own perspective.
Yeah, yeah. We're all here in personal capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so to kick off then, where do you want to start?
Well, I guess stress in academic life is a quite a major topic at the moment, certainly at least in academic Twitter.
Yeah, certainly on my Facebook feed, stress is a big thing that comes up quite regularly. I'll open a debate then by making what I think it might be a controversial point to some people, is I don't think academia is all that stressful. Discuss.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do, so it's obviously an issue point that's up for debate, and I think it depends on the culture in which you sit in within academia, because you hear about a lot of, particularly American academics, who are basically employed to work 6 days a week, or six and a half most of the time, it sounds like, you know, 20 grant applications on the go and being hammered to do 20 hours a day or something ridiculous. And it seems like the UK academic kind of landscape is not that bad, but it's not great either. And a lot of people are having to work on weekends and having to generally just work a lot longer than on their contracted hours. I mean, I was speaking to a professor in sociology a few weeks ago who said he doesn't think he's been contracted more than 37 and a half hours a week, but he's worked on average 70 hours a week for his entire career, he reckons. And I suppose if you're being asked to do that much work, then it's no wonder that some people feel stressed when actually they're being told that they should be able to do it within a normal working week, and it's impossible.
I suppose it depends on then what you mean by academic and academia, because I think what you say probably applies if you were thinking of it just as a teaching role, maybe. But I wonder, especially, for me at least, coming back into it after having worked for quite some time, is I feel like it's more of like a, you could almost call it a vocation. It's a career. It's not to me. I love what I do, and I like learning stuff, and I like talking about the stuff that I do. So to me, reading like all those extra papers or whatever in the evening is something I actually want to do. So to me, therefore, it's not stress.
Yeah, I think this thing though, I'm going to be that annoying guy and say, the usual academic term phrase of, you know, it's complicated. I think what both of you said is completely valid. I think yes, it operates as a vocation and could be great if you enjoy what you do. But also, I think there's a lot to be said around kind of your department's culture or the colleagues with which you work. Because I really believe the way we act with one another in our kind of academic communities really does influence how stressful it can be.
Yeah.
And I think as well, over the years, there has become an increasing demand in terms of workload with increasing cuts, which certainly doesn't help. I think we can do things, and I'm not one to espouse, this individualised rationale, but personally for me, I will deliberately go out of my way to make sure I'm not just looking at the PhD or work the entire time. I will go off and, as you say, leisure read in terms of, because I find that topic interesting.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason that I should have gone and read half the stuff that I have done. It's just I find it interesting, and that's a way for me personally to relax. It's just nice that it ties in a little bit. But I am also incredibly lucky that I have fantastic colleagues who encourage that.
Yeah.
And great supervisors as well who are fine with me, you know, taking that time off. Whereas I'm aware of other instances where people's supervisors have given them a hard time around workload, saying, oh, well, you need to go get it done. Doesn't matter. My favourite one, being a PhD student, this is on a personal level, this isn't anything that can, that's been reported or anything, it's anecdotal. Gone to the supervisor, said, you know, I'm having a hard time, you know, motivating myself at the moment, finding it really hard, I'm getting stressed out with the workload. Apparently their supervisor just turned around, well, it's a PhD, it's supposed to be stressful. Didn't try and help them, didn't talk through any of the options or in terms of kind of like how to better manage their workload, they just said deal with it.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, in that sense, I know, I mean, supervision's a whole podcast in itself, really, isn't it? But I was just saying, but what you say is quite interesting, because I think it is about knowing how to manage yourself effectively, knowing how you work, making the most of your time.
In one sense, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go so far as to say it's solely upon you as the individual. I think a lot of us do internalise those demands made upon us. But then it's also, I think, kind of endemic within academia as well. So we're all generally high achievers once you're at a PhD or beyond.
Yeah, you don't get well, yeah, your PhD program for turning up, do you?
You know, so I think there is that slight neuroses to, you know, you've got to take into consideration the character of someone that wants to go through the kind of self-abuse of the PhD. But
it takes all sorts, though, doesn't it? And I just wonder sometimes, because, again, because I come as an outsider, I mean, part of the idea behind this particular episode was, I see a lot of people posting a lot of rubbish on social media about how stressed they are all the time. They spend more time being stressed than they actually do doing work. And for me, that almost adds to this culture of stress. So you feel like you have to be stressed all the time. And it's just like, guys, just take a step back. You don't kind of realise how lucky you are to be in the situation you're in until you've maybe gone out and experienced some other things. Because some of these people, for my view, and obviously this is my personal view, is that they've never worked like in the real world before. Some like as people I'm talking about, some PhD students here, they haven't necessarily got that experience to actually ground what they're experiencing now in any sort of concrete reality. So to them, it's the biggest, most stressful thing they've ever done. And it's like, guys, you're actually really lucky to be here. It's amazing being at university. You're at one of the best universities in the UK. Sort it out.
I think that's true, but then I think some of us have been involved in a PhD wellbeing survey in my department. Not by any means analysed all the data yet, but big thing to come out of that is in terms of those, it's all anonymous as well. When people have responded, some have said about taking time off, so they do make that time for themselves, but this feeling of guilt whenever they do have time off, which I think in a real world job where you work 9 to 5, you walk out of the office and someone else can pick it up, I think it's much easier to do than when you're thinking through theory and stuff that just lives in your head constantly. How do you get away from that? But then there's also this whole notion of, if I'm actually taking time for myself, well, the work's not getting done, even though I think, personally, there's a lot to be said for taking that time off, because then you can do the work better.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm completely in that boat. I mean, I spend less time on my PhD than most people in my department, and I am further ahead than most people in my department, without wanting to brag too much. It's like, I'm happy to play a couple of hours of computer games in the evening, you know? Because it's like, actually, it's time off. And when I do get to work, it means I'm better at it. I'm not going to sit around sort of procrastinating half the day.
This thing, you know, I think an adage I try and live by is not the amount of hours you put into the work, it's the work you put into the hours. You know, and a good PhD is a done PhD.
It's not a perfect one. That's the classic.
What is it? A great PhD is a published PhD. A good PhD is a done PhD. A perfect one is neither. And you know, and I get it, because the thesis when you're a PhD student, PhD is not just a thing, I think it is a type of lifestyle. It becomes a huge part of your life. The thesis is this, you know, huge individual project that's hanging over your head. Generally, after the thesis, you know, how many people do you know that actually go off and do 3-year long projects completely on their own in isolation? I can't think of anyone that I know that's gone and done that after a PhD. They're generally working on a team.
Yeah.
So you get field assistants to go out and collect the data for you. You know, PhD is the only time you will work solely on something completely on your own.
Well, I suppose just on that point, it depends on what kind of field you're in.
Yeah.
Because a lot of social sciences, it will be it's your work alone, isn't it?
No, because sometimes you'll get research assistants that will go out and do the interviews for you. So, you know, you'll get a list of this is what I'm trying to find, go and interview them.
I suppose, but sometimes quite a lot of academics will write a book themselves and that'll be their
sense, definitely.
But
I mean, how is it in your department, Josh, would you say, in terms of like sort of the academic balance? Because I guess you get, because we're all in different departments for a start, so let's just sort of make that clear. So I think we probably all have very different experiences, because even just talking amongst ourselves, I think we know that our departments are all very different.
Yep.
They all deal with things differently. And so, and also, I find certain subjects attract certain sorts of people. So you find, it's really weird, because you can see this standing outside lecture theatre sometimes. You know when the engineers are in, like, and you also know when the arts and the dance and the theatre students are in, because you can see from the queue of students outside the lecture theatre exactly what sort of students they are. But, so would you say, Josh, that your department's any sort of different?
I think so, actually. Because I'm the law department of the law school. And I think that it has an influence of people who've been out and been solicitors or barristers and then come back into academia and kind of bring sort of some of that lifestyle with them. Because as a solicitor, you're probably expected to do about, I don't know, 8 till 8 with lunch break and a coffee meeting or something within that. And then, you know, you bill somebody £300 an hour. But that kind of expectation that you'll work at home and you'll work quite considerably at home, you know, after the office day is supposed to have finished, I think that kind of it does come into some law schools certainly, and perhaps some more than others. And it's something that I've noticed, but not necessarily. I don't think it's sort of a systematic problem within our law school, because there's also quite a lot of criminologists in our law school. So kind of that more, or kind of that has a tempering effect on kind of the professional lawyering timekeeping, I guess.
And you know, I think as well, it's, as I say, the thesis is a massive part of your life and time as a PhD student, and you know, we pour so much of ourselves into it, I feel. So it is, I think that's where a lot of the stress can come from. And this is not to devalue the process in any way. As we say, you know, the best PhD is a done PhD. Personally for me, I'm just regarding the PhD as something, it's a training process. The whole point is it's a learning curve.
Mm. Yeah, I think when I started my PhD, most of the academics I spoke to kind of said it's an apprenticeship of being a researcher or something similar to that, and I think that is what it is. But at the same time, you're also kind of inundated with hearing about people who've done their PhD, got their PhD published almost immediately.
The bar's constantly being put.
Yeah, and then time. You know, became a lecturer at 21, and then a senior lecturer at 20 something else, and there's a professor of philosophy I think at Oxford who's 24, and I'm like, he's already beating me at life quite considerably. But because I think you kind of like everything on social media, kind of you're bombarded with not so just not images in academia, but knowledge of the people who are doing amazing things. And actually you probably have to make peace with the fact that you're probably going to be, there's a high likelihood you might just be an average person.
Yeah.
If you're in academia, you're not an average person. I don't know anybody who you would class as normal in academia.
None of us are normal.
Not even in terms of their personality, but certainly not in terms of achievement. I mean, you don't, as we said, you don't get onto a PhD program just for turning up, do you?
Yeah.
So it's a kind of, to, like you mentioned before, to be in, spend most of your life probably as a high achiever, and then to turn up here and put a ton of work in, probably more work than you've ever done in your life.
Life slap you in the face and then you're utterly average.
Yeah, and then be an average of the high achievers. Yeah. It's quite difficult for some, I think.
I think as well, something you've mentioned chimes in terms of how the stress, it can be the individual perception of it and how to handle that. But I think as well it is endemic in the system in terms of, you know, getting these people that tell you like, oh, you know, it's not enough to have the PhD anymore, you need to get published.
Mm.
Oh, it's not enough to be published there, you have to go into a high impact one. How much outreach have you done? Have you done any teaching? What about your marking? Have you thought about going here? Have you done a year off in somewhere else? It's like, calm down. So
if I'd just done a PhD and nothing else, life would be fine.
Yeah.
It's all the other stuff on top of it.
All that stuff that mounts up and... you know, I was about to make a point that now eludes me.
Well, I mean, doing the PhD is a process that takes 3 or 4 years in itself. So then to add on teaching, publications, outreach, blogging, impacts, podcasting, whatever else it is, it's extra stuff on top.
Completely then.
Yeah.
It's extra stuff on top that you're expected to do, but actually you're not provided with the extra time to do it necessarily.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it becomes this massive juggling act. And I think the point I was going to make was when you said about how it's, you know, you're told it's an apprenticeship towards becoming an academic. Now, I think I now know 14 people that have finished their PhDs. I think only one of them staunchly wants to remain in academia. Three of them are at the moment. Of those other two, one came in and said, no, I want to be an academic. Spoke to them the other week and they were like, no, I'm just sick of this game now. It's complete bull. The other ones just said, I'm going to see how it goes along. Yeah. Now, if you were to take an apprenticeship anywhere else and you had a dropout rate that high or people that were that upset and wound up with the system, anywhere else would stop and check in and have a word with itself and be like, hang on a minute, everyone here is buggering off.
Mm.
What's going on?
But I think it's interesting that you used the word apprenticeship because I wonder if it is an apprenticeship these days. I'm thinking maybe a generation or two back, you could say, yeah, you come into university, you're going to be moulded into being this sort of research teaching machine.
Mm-hmm.
But now it just feels like, I mean, one of my supervisors I haven't seen for 2 years. Like,
yeah.
So I can't be apprentice to him. And my other supervisor, we'd get on fine, but it's not like that I'm actively, it's kind of like I'm an apprentice to myself almost because... And because of the competition, and because basically all these fusty old academics aren't retiring, there's no jobs for us.
Yeah.
So we have to go out of our way to sort of do as much as we can to try and stand out from the crowd, only to then find that actually there's someone that's done everything we've done, but just slightly more.
I mean, back to the apprentice point, actually, something I just thought of. If you know, if you're an apprentice cabinet maker or something, the final thing you would make as an apprentice would be an amazing cabinet.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess that's like making the PhD, you know, producing the PhD something that is amazing to you and is the... The top end of your skill level. But actually, when you're a PhD student, because you're encouraged to teach and publish and whatever else, you're expected to compete above your skill level that you're supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you know when you're told to publish in a 4-star journal or whatever, you're being told to compete at a world class level when you have neither the training nor the experience to compete at that. So
nor the time
exactly. So it's not really a wonder why people find it really difficult to do all this extra stuff.
Mm.
And I mean, also as well, the turnover rate in some of those channels, even if you are able to compete at that level, you know, you get some that have a turnover rate, you could be looking at 18 to 24 months to by the time you've submitted it, gone through the review process, and then it's finally coming out.
Mm.
You know, 2 years down the road, we'll hopefully have been done and dusted and sodded off.
And you don't get to put that on your CV until they've accepted it, do you? So you've basically... So this is something I'm thinking about at the moment, because I'm... about to apply for jobs, but I've got a publication that I'm waiting to hear back from. And I'm like, what? Do you kind of put it on my CV or not?
I mean, personally, the advice I've had from a senior academic has just been, if you've got something kind of in the works, just write it down. Just say what stage of the process. So don't say it's published or forthcoming. Just say in review.
See, that's a good plan.
Yeah.
Do that.
Because then it looks like, you know, it's like I've got stuff ready to hit the ground running with. It was the advice I've had anyway. But I think in terms of the more... general system, so you know, kind of like how all this expectation is kind of like foisted upon us.
Mm.
This is something I was discussing with a colleague a few weeks back. I think, and it goes back to something I mentioned earlier on, I think the most radical thing we can do in terms as colleagues, because certainly my colleagues have got me through a lot of the PhD process, is you get this whole notion of basically being kind and trying to help one another out. I think there's a lot to be said around being honest in our research, in terms of, I'm going to be the first one to tell you if something's gone horribly wrong with mine. You know, like last year, bumped into you afterwards, I think, Josh.
Conference.
went to India for data collection. Mm. Whole 2 weeks there, and said, "Oh, cool! I'm going to be there. I'm going to get a load of data.
Yeah,
going to interview a load of people. That's an enjoy a 14-hour flight back. I had no data.
Oh,
yeah, I know it had gone horribly wrong, and just." But fortunately, it's a 14-hour flight, so you got a lot of time to
think about it,
process it, and then realise, actually, it doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, you've got to be nice, and you've got to be honest, as you say, because I think one thing that doesn't help with the social media generation is there's this pressure to not be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything has got to be presented sort of perfect smiles, researching all the time.
I mean, the classic line is, it's social media is everybody's highlight reel, and it's never the outtakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems the same on, on academic Twitter, pretty much. I mean... when someone says, "Oh, I've just had four journal articles published," and then you actually dig around and find out that it's a journal that's published by their friend,
and it's not peer reviewed. Their reviews, they're not actually.
Yeah, so it's not. So there's kind of there's a degree of, I don't know, it's not lying, is it? But it's presenting something as better, being better than it is, and it makes everybody else feel rubbish.
Being inventive with the truth.
That's the phrase, isn't it?
Because, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for this kind of, you know, I kind of registered this point about a year ago. One of my office mates turned around to me and just said, like, thank you for being honest about stuff, because at that point I was looking at methods and, you know, I'm a theorist. I'm not too fond of going out, you know, collecting data and stuff. I'll be the first to admit that I'll do it, but it's not my favourite part, and I will whinge about it. But you know, they just said, like, oh, it's nice to know, you know, not, because you get this whole persona like, oh no, you know, it's all going great, or but I feel like it's extreme of two ends. It's either it's going perfect, or people will tell you that it's all falling apart. Like, well, you probably kick them out in the middle somewhere, really.
Yeah.
You know, but I think as well, on top of the honesty, I think in terms of the way the system is at the moment, going back to that notion of kindness, of being kind to one another, so there's being honest can help allay one of the fears, because we all know, actually, it's not just me.
Yeah.
But also, being kind, you know, it's a quote from a Cambridge academic at the time, back in the early 90s, to a new colleague. So it's no use trying to be clever. We're all clever here. Just try to be kind.
Oh, that's kind of,
and I think that's incredibly true of the academic system. We're all clever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be cynical again. I like being cynical. But because of the way the marketplace is, there's an element, I think, that we're encouraged not to be kind.
Yeah.
And I think this is the problem. We should be kind, you're right. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, sometimes you have these conversations with people and they sign up to things. You think, are you doing this because you want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you doing this because you want to get something out of it?
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, it's because they want to get something out of it.
I think what you've just said there touches on a really key point when we talk about the marketplace. I think that's a big issue within academia at the moment. This whole, you know, various academics talk about the neoliberalisation of the academy.
Yeah.
This whole idea that, oh, you know, I've got to look after myself. But then it really strikes me when I go to, you know, talks by quote unquote radical scholars and they spouse all this stuff. And it's like, right, that's great in theory, but is it truly radical in the sense of, or are you just saying it because you know you're going to get a good publication out of it?
Yeah. Or
and that speaks to my cynicism, but also it's like, well, I don't see how this is being relayed in practice.
But also, they've been marketed as being radical.
Well,
I mean, this is the thing, some PR person somewhere
has
gone, yeah, we need to really sell this ad campaign, so we're going to call them radical.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's radical, everyone's cutting edge, everyone's leading, novel, exciting. But no, we're all just sort of just muddling along, really.
This thing, because, you know, it's a quote by an anonymous source, but who's saying, you know, research isn't, you know, nothing's radical if lay people can't understand it and it's not accessible to them. You know, because we often talk about radical research in the academy, but, you know, how often does it actually get beyond the ivory tower? You know, you've yet to tear down these walls because, yeah, it might be that you've come out with a great, you know, theory. Are you able to articulate that to, you know, go down the pub and talk to someone normally about it?
Because
I think there's a lot to be said for the act of, you know, quote unquote translation around our research. Like, it's in this academic language, we need to switch that.
Yeah.
So it's relatable.
Well, I think that's very true. I mean, because your title that we discussed in the previous episode is quite
a mouthful.
It's a mouthful.
No,
yeah.
I think, yeah.
But ultimately, when I describe you to friends, I say, oh, you know, Craig. Yeah. He does space colonialism.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite cool. I mean, to most people at university, I understand what colonialism is. That's fine.
Yeah.
But even then, you can then break that down further to then describe it to lay people. And I think that's quite interesting.
Well, I think that's another skill, just to add more skills that people in academia even need. Being able to talk to lay people, I think, is really important. Like, there's a plain English campaign, which I think is so important. Because what is the point? If you're in a niche field and you do something so theoretical that only five people in the world can understand it, only those five people are ever going to read it.
Yep.
What is the point? Does it actually? How far does that progress anything?
Well,
if there's only five people who can understand it, because if you wrote it in a more accessible way, 50 people might read it, and then person 49 or 50 might be able to contribute the next, you know, maybe to build on your ideas.
You know, I think this is where it's important, because, you know, how do we go about conceiving of impact or outreach? So normally you'll be like, oh, what's the impact factor of this journal or star rating or however you want to rank it. Normally, on average, we know generally you're going to get cited by about 3 people, maybe by 10. You know, what's more impactful? That, which is generally behind a paywall as well. So you have to be able to have the financial capital to get past that. Once you're beyond that, you have to also have the kind of academic capital to be able to translate the damn thing into plain English and make sense of it. Or, you know, things that won't really count towards you. Say, for instance, I don't know, you go out and give a talk on one of your topics to sellout crowd, 150 people, 3 weeks on a trot. There's 450 people, you know, that's way more than they're actually going to bother reading or citing your article.
Mm.
But also, you can't account for all of the impact either. You know, like, you don't know if something you've said to someone that's 16 has inspired them to go uni or not.
Mm.
You know, there's a whole host of invisible.
And that doesn't require a PhD, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, like, if you go out and give a talk to a public lecture or whatever, and you speak to 150 people, person 78 might go and tell their friends down the pub the next night, and then the friend might go and do something else, and then something else, and something else, and suddenly it's got a ton of impact that you didn't even realise, because actually...
Yeah.
So the notion of counting impact in any way.
This is the thing. It's like I really don't feel that you can put, you know, a metric on impact.
Mm.
You know, like, say for instance, when I've gone back home, a few of my friends back home, their kids are now looking at going to university. Their first generation university goers. I'm the only person they know that's been.
Mm.
So they'll ask me, like, how does this process work? Well, what's more impactful? Me, I don't know, writing, going off to a conference and giving a talk, or me helping them out. What's more impactful?
Absolutely, yeah.
So how do you account for that?
But the market tells us that we need to publish in really high rating journals that no one's going to read, about obscure topics that are too complicated for most people to understand, and to spend our lives worrying about it.
Yep.
Yeah, and somehow doing more of that means that the university is allowed to charge more money. Yep. For undergraduate students.
But also, you know, I think as well, we have this whole justification system. So, colleague Becky Whittle and I have just been accepted, funnily enough, for a conference talk on it. You know, like, the way higher education sector at the moment justifies itself is like, oh, well, you know, we're a public good, we're a public service.
Mm.
Mm.
And I think that is, you know, perfectly valid and well and true. However, I would push back and say, well, actually, the public's a body multiple. Which public are you serving, and how do you actually do that? Because, again, if it's behind a paywall, well, we already know roughly what section of that public
you're
addressing, those who can afford it. You know, how do you actually make it accessible to those who are otherwise excluded from the system?
Yeah, I mean, I was at a conference last year.
It's still a few weeks.
That's right. So I was at a conference last year, and one of the attendees was in our kind of schedule was talking about how we need to make these papers are open access, because we were talking about making a special issue of a journal. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the point came up that actually it costs like £2,000-£4,000 to make a journal article that would normally be behind a paywall open access. And actually someone said, well, why don't we just post it all on academia.edu or SSRN or
host your own website.
Or host your own website or ResearchGate or something like that. And actually, it doesn't subvert the model of the academic publishing model, does it? But it enables the outreach to be much broader.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact that you can, as soon as it's been accepted, you could publish it on any of those websites.
Mm.
And people can read it, people can cite it,
yeah.
You know, before the fact that the journal's got a 6-month lead-in time before it's even...
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because this comes on something I think we might talk about in another week about...
Self-publishing.
Well, about self-publishing, yeah, we could talk about that. But I was thinking more in line of truth and knowledge and value on the internet. Because, I mean, we've seen this before with academia.eu and all these sort of things. Mm. I mean, people just publish any old thing on there and there's no way to validate it.
Yeah, I mean, once when I was on... when I used to follow a couple of guys in terrorism studies on academia.edu, and at least one of them used to publish something every single week, something multiple times a week. And I was like, how is this guy doing this? Mm. So I had a quick look, and it was just like a one-page newsletter of trash, frankly.
But I mean, obviously, I didn't want to go off topic, but I mean, it's just really just to say that I agree. I completely agree. You're right, because we could go out and publish something tomorrow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the In the Zone podcast website, even. there has to be some sort of gatekeeper to tell people this is worthwhile. But then those people that are doing that are charging thousands and thousands of pounds. Because they can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're an academic, you're forced to put your supposed to publish, and your labour is free. You get no money for it, and it's a lot of money. It's a lot of labour that you're putting into it. You're not getting paid for it. Somebody else is getting paid for it. People at the journal. Well, not even the journal. Usually, it's the journal publisher, isn't it?
Cause this thing, so you submit it to a paywall journal. So you've submitted it for free. You're not going to get anything back for it. It then gets peer reviewed by people that do it for free because of the honour of, you know, the prestige of that review process. It then gets edited by people who might be a little bit financially reimbursed, generally not. And then you have to pay to access your own work.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, that's why academic publish houses make so much profit compared to non-academic publishers.
I mean, but if you thought about that in the real world, it just wouldn't make sense. I mean, if I was going to publish a book, like I asked all of you to write a chapter for my book, and it got made a band of people, but you'd have to do it for free, give it to me, I'll publish it, but I'll make all the money on it, and you're not getting any of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense, does
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Not at all.
It makes no sense at all. In fact, I was saying to a friend the other week, it probably makes more sense, really, to just hoard all of your research during the PhD and then fire out a bunch of books.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to be an author, be an author.
Yeah, exactly.
Sack it.
But maybe that's, I mean, that's probably a topic for another podcast. Yeah. I mean, just to round up, as we're sort of coming to the end of this episode, one big question for everyone. Is the academic life worth it? Is academia worth it, do you think, here in 2019?
Here in 2019. I don't know, is the honest answer, I think, for me, because I was going to, well, it's hard, it's a hard job, actually. It's far harder than anybody realises, but all jobs are far harder than anybody realises. So I don't think that's necessarily, you know, that affects anything whether it's worth it. Because, you know, there's a few people recently who started to recall the idea that actually, if you're going to do something that's a big task and in your job, that really should be something that's meaningful to you. Mm-hmm. I think academia can be meaningful because you can change the world in a way. If your research gets picked up by the right people who do the right things with it, then you can change the world. But you're probably not likely to do that. You're probably likely to end up in a mediocre university, a mediocre place in the league table doing all right work. But it's your work. You've got the freedom to do it. And you can kind of do whatever you want within certain boundaries. But sometimes it seems like those boundaries are becoming tighter and tighter, and teaching demand seems to be going up because there's more students. Admin demand seems to be going up because there's more students. You're seeming to have to spend your research time applying for grants that you should be spending, you know, actually doing the research. It sounds like people, a lot of academics now don't actually have time to do it. Well, several academics who I know don't have time to do research because they've got so much other stuff
to do. Well, they're not paid to do research even nowadays. You don't even get paid, some of them.
Some people,
just on teaching
only contracts, yeah. So I think it probably depends on the role you're in. I don't think you can say is academia worth it, actually. I think maybe it depends on whether your role at that particular university in that particular department at that particular time is worth it, because it all seems so different, and maybe the risk of getting into one that's not worth it is something to think about, at least. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm going to have to...
Sorry, I'm going on a bit of a rant.
No, it's all right. I think I agree with Josh. I can't say definitively whether or not it is worth it. I think if you're really passionate about your topic, you know, and it gives you a reason to get out of bed in the morning, then yeah, it's more than worth it. However, increasing workload and expectation then weighs against that. So much akin to what Josh has just said. I think the value that I found within academia is, so I started off, I still enjoy my research area. However, I don't think it's something that I'm going to spend the next 50 years on. What I found incredibly worthwhile during the PhD topic is having that time to explore those other fields. And then kind of, yeah, basically after this, I get to, there aren't many jobs where after you've finished one part, you can then try and reframe and re-articulate yourself and then go into another area. You know, because certainly through this PhD topic, you know, I've got really into class studies, so, you know, what does it mean to be a working class academic? Things around elite studies. I never thought I'd enjoy methodology. That's something that I enjoy. Yeah, I know. Big revelation for me after 5 years of despising it, being like, hang on a minute, it's not too bad. Things around like the geographies of emotion, stuff around that.
Wow.
So, you know, there aren't many jobs where we can, at the end of one project, turn around and be like, actually, I'm going to sack that off, do something else entirely.
Yeah.
So we're fortunate in that sense. However, with the increase in demands, you know, at least outside of the academy, you can turn up at 9 a.m, bugger off at 5 and just leave it there. It's not rattling around in your head for hours. You can just switch off and let, I don't know, Jaff pick up the crap you've left behind.
Yeah, I think it really depends who you are.
Yeah.
And what you're doing and why you're doing it. Yeah. I think maybe there's a lot of people in academia that maybe aren't suited to being in academia. I don't know. I mean, that's a controversial topic. Yeah. I admit. But I'd say I think academia is changing, but there's a lot of people in it who have been here for a very awful long time, yeah. And maybe the world's changing around them.
But I don't know if academia is changing for the better.
Well, that's a very good question.
We've already mentioned the kind of the neoliberalisation of the academy and the turning it into a business. And
Vicky Loveday refers to as the neuroliberalisation of the academy, which is
that's a good word.
It's not only neoliberal, but you know, it's whole Foucauldian notion of you kind of then like start to self-regulate and you internalise those values.
Oh, that's very much that's up my alley. That is, yeah. So yourself, but you're just a product of the machine, but you're driving the machine. Your desire is manufactured by the system. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you quite often see that a number of academics certainly the neoliberalisation, if we're going to call it that, of the academy has started to affect them in such a way that actually a lot of them are speaking out about it now. But is it going to change? I mean, how many people speak out about big issues all the time and nothing happens? And
I mean, I think this is part of the issue, is for you to still have a viable career within academia, you have to kind of toe that line, no matter how much you hate it. But then at what point will it get to when will it get to a breaking point?
Well, I mean, most early career researchers now are on 2-3-4 year contracts. Like,
if they're lucky.
If they're lucky, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. There are a lot of people I know that do 6-month contracts.
Yeah, I mean,
be down in Plymouth for 6 months and then have to hightail it up to Dundee for the other 6.
In fact, I saw an advert the other day for a volunteer lecturer who was going to be paid expenses. I mean, how horrendous is that? For someone
that's
who...
not a job advert.
Exactly, it's horrendous.
One day slavery.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, if you come to a university and you do a PhD, you achieve the greatest level of education possible in the world, to then not be able to get a decent job is actually, it's not a great deal actually, is it? And it's no wonder the amount of PhD students who have said, no, I don't want to be here anymore. And a lot of PhD students I know, including myself, turned up and said, I really want to be an academic at the end of this. Mm-hmm. And actually now I'm not so sure. I'm not sure. And a lot of people have said, I'm definitely sure that I don't want to be here.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, for the sake of honesty that I spoke about earlier on, you know, I came in before my undergrad knowing that I wanted to be an academic. You know, cause I just really enjoy the idea of researching and lecturing. Those are the parts that I enjoy.
Yeah. I don't think anyone enjoys the admin.
Yeah, yeah. But I have questions throughout the course of this PhD. Is this something I still want to do?
Yeah.
You know, with the way the system is at the moment, because I think there was something posted on Shit Academics Say the other day, which was I'm going to leave academia to pursue my passions.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, yeah. Research and teaching. It's like yeah.
I mean, it's because everyone accepts that there's admin to do, and fine, you've got, that's the price you pay for being able to, or that's your price. That's the price you should be paying to do teaching and research, but at the moment it doesn't seem like actually it's a fair deal.
And well, this is the thing. I mean, there is a large movement nationally around the I'm plugging myself here, there is an anti-casualisation movement.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
Within academia, you know, so this whole idea that there's a 6-month contract, like, well, is that justifiable? Like, have you pulled that from?
Yeah,
we spoke before about kind of academia being a vocation, and it seems like a lot of these short-term contracts are exploiting the belief that it's a vocation.
This thing, I think as well, you know, this idea of academia as a vocation, there is some truth to it, but I think it is a romanticised version, and basically by perpetuating that idea, like, oh no, you know, we're really lucky to be here and stuff, kind of like, it's a way of justifying the crap that you have to deal with. In one sense, I mean, you know, as we've spoken, it is much more complicated than that. But I think holding to this romanticised notion of what is, like, oh, it's a vocation, like, maybe it was, I don't think it is anymore.
No. So do we just have to come to terms with the fact it's not what we think it is, academia?
I think that's actually coming to terms with the reality of academia is something that everyone has to do, isn't it? And then
what is academia? What is knowledge? Why are we here?
Yeah.
Why do we bother?
The big questions. But I think once you've thought about what is academia, mm-hmm. and what is academia gonna might what might it be in the future, you know, over the course of a career, actually then you can start to think, do I still want to be here?
Yeah, and I think as well, there was a note to any you know, people that are early on in their PhDs listening to this, like, should point out that it's, you know, not all doom gloom high and whiskey, but also brace yourself, like, you will have these like crises of being. Yeah.
It's got to be realistic, I think.
Yeah, maybe we're all in crisis at the moment. Yeah. No, but I mean, yeah, I regularly talk to academics who say it's too much work, but I also regularly talk to academics who say, actually, I have so much freedom and I really enjoy the bits. The bits that I enjoy are so good that it's worth doing.
Yeah.
But that's a personal decision, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, certainly when I've kind of like had these kind of like little self-imposed crises of, is this something I still want to be doing? And a good question to ask yourself is, well, if not this, then what? And I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I enjoy my work. I enjoy the fact that I get to have these conversations.
Look at us. We're sitting in a room recording a podcast on a bright, lovely day. You're sitting here in shorts.
Yeah.
We're chatting about interesting things. What more could you want?
Well, exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. So, like, I wouldn't change it for something else. But having said that, I do think there's a lot to be said. We can acknowledge that it is, you know, a good position to be in. But I don't think there's anything wrong with pointing out that it could be better and trying to work towards that.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, someone said to me the other day, what would you do if you won the lottery?
Yeah.
And I said, actually, I'd probably do a bunch of visiting fellowships at various universities across the world. Because actually, you get to do stuff that you enjoy. You get to travel. Well, you know, it's a great, that would be great. But is the rest of it in academia that's not so great? Is it worth putting up with?
Yeah.
That's the question, isn't it?
I mean, that's the thing, I think. Well, it's like with any job, really, is once you start to not enjoy it more than you do enjoy it, well, then that's when you have to start weighing up. That's the same with any job, like.
Yeah.
Well, I think on that note, that sort of brings us to the end. Thank you very much, Craig, for joining us. On that chipper note, cool, thank you very much. We'll see you next time.
Awesome, cheers.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.